okay? You're just talking about, you know, plain old digital data. You know what data to expect. You can identify what's going on. It's the same thing with the PTS phones. Just, you know, that's TDMA, but that you still have to know what the switching sequence is. It can switch up to 1,600 channels in a second. So, you know, you've got to sync up. If you can get past the hardware point, then the software can make the identification pretty easy.
Boy, this is a challenge. But I still see, you know, four possible avenues to begin a solution of this difficult problem. Anybody got any further comments?
Mr. IKT.
Mr. IKT, is that over your name, sir?
Sure, my name is George. The stuff that you usually use for wireless as I think somebody else, just because you put something on the same channel or the same frequency range, doesn't mean you could duplicate the protocol or the sequence of events to exchange information. Security system is typically some encapsulation. It's called IPsec. IPsec is of leaving a tunnel within a tunnel, which the system can read, get the packet routed, but the contents of that packet are an encrypted packet, which only the end nodes would know the correct key to. Over.
The B2RY war checking in. What a question, not on the subject.
Joe's recognized. George from Hicksville, you didn't have your PL turned on your transmitter, so therefore you kept dropping out. We had to keep keying the transmitter to hear your solution. So do turn on your PL 136.5, you know, 4Z, so that you come through the machine continuously. I was hearing you on the input. Does anyone need a repeat of what George just said? Because some of it got dropped out. Give me a call, let us. Okay. Does anybody think that what George just said is a solution?
Well, let me put it this way, Dick, if I may.
You got it, Alex.
I think there are two events in the life of a communication between the cell phone and the towers. First part of the event is that it has to come in clear, so the tower will know to whom it talks to, and it has to include some sort of ID, semi-permanent ID. So the phone now talks to the tower in clear in the beginning, saying, "Hey, here I am. I'm ready to talk to you." Now the tower comes back and say, "Here, it's a new key for your encryption." And this guy goes and encrypts. Now, not everything else is encrypted. I think in this first part of the protocol, there lies the solution for my problem. Now, back to Dick.
Q-Chiefer. Yeah, I'm worried about that one because of the anti-cloning method. Bill, QGZ, go right ahead.
Oh, Alpha GSN numbers they used to steal, but they changed that whole system. What's wrong with three different ringtones?
Bill, good suggestion, Eric. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, okay, that's where I was going before. In other words, you don't necessarily send that number contained in your SIM. You send that when you first power the phone up, and when requested to by the network or when your phone's been off for some considerable period of time. That's a soft number that changes more often than I think would be effective for what we're looking to do with it. So it's not like you come up in the clear every single time. You come up in the clear, you build your encryption, you're assigned your temp. In other words, I haven't thought about this in quite a while. But in other words, you're basically setting your code word for your encryption that first time you power up, and then every so often thereafter, but not necessarily every time you power cycle the phone. It's going to be driven by the system. So, you know, semi-permanent, yeah, but certainly not. I don't know if I would count on that. The thing we were talking about was to try to use the phone as an RFID device to, for example, identify someone at a door or open a door for you. Well, if that's the case, that's only going to work when the phone transmits, and that's only going to be on demand of the system to say, "Hey, it's been a while. Where are you? Where do I physically direct your calls?" I don't think that's happening in any case any more frequently than at like 10-minute intervals on a bad day.
KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn recognized, but Bill, let me go back to you. Are you telling me that in general, the cell phone only gives a burst of information once every 10 minutes? I have the impression that it does that a lot more frequently, and here's what makes me think that. In one of the salt mines I work at, we're in a basement, we're far away from cell sites, therefore, each time the cell phone has to do an ID, it's got to do it at maximum power. And the people in that location are complaining about the fact that the battery on the cell phone runs down real fast when they're in that location. The only way they can get around that problem is to go to that location where they got poor cell site coverage, let's say very few bars, so to speak, and turn the darn thing off. Turn the darn thing off to save its battery. So if you kill a battery that fast, I think it's more than once every 10 minutes. I think it's once every few seconds the thing, in some cases, is doing a transmission. Maybe I'm wrong on this one. Bill first, WB2QGZ, go right ahead.
No, you're absolutely right, it does. In fact, it will, there's two things going on. Number one is power. As you noticed, it's going to try to scream at high power, and it's going to do it more frequently, and that will kill your battery. It'll also, your battery will also croak a lot sooner if you're far from a cell, and it's the phone's required to make more power to talk back. When it does periodically talk back, when it has nothing there, it's going to be trying it, and it's not as much like it's transmitting, but there's an incredible amount of power saving in the CDMA devices based on it knows when to wake up, based on where it stands in the grand scheme of things. In other words, the duty cycle is arranged such that that phone is off much more than it's on when it's not making a call. So when you're in the basement and you have no, if you want to call it, control channel to look at, the device is going to be on much, much more often, scanning through its channels, its available channels, and the codes it needs to demod in its priority roaming list to determine, all right, am I in my network? If I'm not in my network, am I in a friendly network? And in other words, I'm in an area out of town with three different networks, which one do I want to be on? So that phone, having no signal, is doing an incredible amount of thinking and listening to try to figure out where it is and make the light turn red to green. So it's not like it's down here transmitting in the blind, but the receiver's on continuously for all the time these people are downstairs. Once you come upstairs, that receiver may come on once every 15 seconds or something like that. In other words, the phone knows when to expect a call from the cell. The cell knows to hold that information for the phone until the appropriate moment when the phone is awake. So it's, again, that duty cycle that's killing the battery gun.
WB2EAV.
EAV recognized. Glenn is first. WB2QIQ, go ahead. QCQ.
Actually, what I know about the phones, when you first turn them on, they ID themselves. So that SIM card that's inside is sending out a very, very specific network information that's going back to the first cell site that it can attach to. It updates the time. It sends out a code that basically identifies who it is and what network to attach to. Because just because it's attaching to a cell site, one cell site might attach to quite a few different networks and different types of networks within one cell site. So the one phone itself, when it does attach, it's awake and it's on the network. Now, the duty cycle between transmit and receive, the amount of receive is much more than the transmit when you're not talking and you're not, but you're always connected to that network. The minute that phone is on and you're attached to a network, you can actually see the connection to the network itself. It is handshaked, but the amount of bandwidth it's taking, digital bandwidth, because the amount of information being exchanged is very, very low. So that's the duty cycle difference, but you're still on a channel, and you're still connected, and you're still handshaked the whole time. KC2, QIQ, hope that straightens out something.
Yeah, QG said that's when you're in a call. When you're in idle mode, it doesn't work that way.
I think it does, because when you're listening in idle mode, what's happening with the phone is still ID'd to the network. If you look on it, otherwise it would go into a roam mode, and you would actually see it's still receiving and giving some message back to the network to tell the network that it's there. Because if it was in receive and you turn the phone off, the network would still think that the phone's in the network, and that's definitely not happening. KC2, QIQ.
Now, once the phone comes up, it doesn't really talk again until it needs to. It would need to when it
physically moves and needs to update the network to its location. Otherwise, it's, there's a significant period of time when that phone is physically off, other than having a little timer in its brain that says, in 5 seconds, I need to wake up. I need to see if the network is telling me something, and at that point, it would respond. But it is certainly not transmitting other, in other words, on a regular basis, to say, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. If it did, it would destroy that battery in no time.
From what I understand, it is being polled continuously, and not only that, the phone service can tell your location. As a matter of fact, you can pay for that service as GPS through the internet, but there's also a networking, but not all telephone companies are using it, where they do poll the phones, and they know the location of the phones and what cell they're at. KC2, QIQ.
Okay. We can do that based on asking the phone where it last registered. If you pay for one of these, like the Who's Messing With My Dots on the Map GPS location on a phone, where you can pay $5 or $10 a month and have your dot move around, your location information is totally, that information is totally separate from what is communicated to the network. That information goes via, like a text message or via data in the phone, back to, it's a totally separate device. The location information that's encoded from the phone is totally separate from all of those applications. In other words, a lot of the phones you can say, oh, or, you know, it'll ask you permission to turn on your GPS for location like that. That's only for user-selectable applications. The GPS is always on for the system, for the E911 functionality. But, again, that device is not transmitting unless... When you're in a call, yeah, in some modes, the duty cycle of the transmit can vary based on whether there's audio information being encoded or not. In other words, it doesn't come up hard in the air. But when you're an idle, you're not talking. I mean, the reason I know that is I can see when I drive test when my phone is in transmit, and it's not in transmit very often. In other words, I have an extended display out of the phone showing me a lot of system parameters, and I'm aware because the color of my display changes when the phone's updating. So it's really not that often.
Let me just ask you this question. Right now I have a spectrum analyzer. I've got my cell phone sitting on the desk over here, and I've got a sniffing antenna. And I'm measuring something at about 825 megahertz, and I am not making a phone call right now, and the phone is sitting right there. What's that? I mean, granted, I know that that level goes up much higher when I'm making a phone call, but there's something coming out of that phone right now, and it's not making a phone call.
That happens here, too.
Don't know. I'm assuming if you're at 825, it's a Verizon device, and it's a CDMA 800.
Bill, is that possibly the local oscillator for the receiver that these guys are seeing with their sniffer into the spectrum analyzer? Back to you, Bill.
FBI. Well, 825, I believe, is in the uplink band. I don't have a lot of experience with 800 CDMA. I don't use it. And I don't have to fix it. But yeah, my guess was going to be LO. But you should also see the LO bouncing, because it's only going to be up when the receiver's on. So that's, in other words, you should actually see it coming and going.
Hey, Glenn, when you're using your spectrum analyzer right now and you're seeing that 800 meg signal, is it on 825 megacycles without switching frequency? Is it completely steady in amplitude? If I watch it for 5 solid minutes, does it ever blast to a higher amplitude? What do you see on that spectrum analyzer screen? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm right on target with you here, because I'm listening to this and something here doesn't ring right, because if I turn the phone off, there's nothing that comes out of this. Then I turn it on, and boy, just the minute you turn it on, boy, it gives you a nice, hefty output. And the frequency is pretty much the same, but you can see that the content and the bandwidth or whatever's coming out of it is a lot greater. Then what I did was, then it said the phone settles out, and it sits there, and I would say that the signal drops down. It's the same frequency, but it drops down about 60 dB. I mean, it drops down quite a bit, but there's still something coming out. And I said, no, it's not LO, because it's RF. And I'm sweeping now, while I'm talking here, I'm sweeping across. I don't see a whole heck of a lot going on just about anywhere. But then again, if the RF carrier areas at that level is down, heck, that's got to be down like minus 80 dB. I mean, it's just above the noise floor there. I don't see anything else, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
Put the spectrum analyzer in zero span while you're centered on it.
Sorry. Is that? But I have a closed field probe here, and when I run that probe over the body of the cell phone, the spectrum analyzer does not register anything. Only when the probe is on the antenna, it registers the same thing, about every 5 to 10 seconds, another pulse.
Is that some kind of a pilot tone or a periodically transmitted pilot tone, Bill? QGZ, go ahead.
Okay, not in any way that I know either the IDEN or CDMA networks work. No, not that I know of. Now, the interesting thing here, remember that the CDMA signal that you're sending back to the cell is a meg and a quarter wide. And I typically can't see that unless I average or max hold. Now, I'm not usually sitting right in front of a phone looking at it. I'm usually looking at a site, out of a duplexer, and I want to see what's going on, so I will max hold on a channel, and I will then start to see noise floor rise with a bunch of subs coming in simultaneously. But remember that in CDMA, every site, every cell is on the same channel. So it's not like amps where everybody's spread out, everybody has their own channel. Your phone, Glenn, is on the same frequency as every other phone in your house and every one of your neighbor's phones and everybody else using Verizon that hashes to that number. Hashing is simply an algorithm based on your subscriber ID and in a multi-cell, multi-frequency cell where you have a bunch of channels for capacity, it'll just assign you off the bat to a different channel to spread you around. But in a single channel cell, everybody's on that same frequency. And you're all in that big, meg and a quarter wide spread out to signal.
This is why it's operating so often. It tries to find clear channel, and then it backs up because it finds somebody else there. So this is why it's trying again until it finally gets through. So that will repeat probably until it gets through, and then it will go to nanny for a period of time, and it will try again. So I can see a variation of the duty cycle, but never to hours or whatever.
No, it's the way CDMA works is everybody lives on that same channel with a different code. It never goes to a different channel looking for an empty one because there are no empty channels. That's the way CDMA works.
Think of it as spread spectrum because that's really what it is.
If it observes that his transmission is garbled or if the channel is busy, it backs off and it tries then next time on a random time. It has a random timer inside. Okay, let's try in about 5 seconds or 6 seconds or whatever. Is the channel clear now? This is why it's doing it so often.
Now, again, that's not the way it works. Everyone occupies the exact same meg and a quarter at the same time. You have three phones in the same room on the same cell site from the same carrier. They're all occupying that same exact spectrum simultaneously with a different code. And the base station is able to, because it's spread spectrum, like Eric says, it can decode your stream and the stream of the other two phones at the same time. There's no holding off. There's no waiting for a clear channel or a clear time slot because there are no clear channels and there are no clear time slots in CDMA.
It's spread spectrum.
Yeah, it's spread spectrum within the 1.5 megahertz or whatever. But what is it called, CDMA? CDMA stands for collision detect multiple axes. You detect the collision, you back off. Isn't that so?
Code division multiple axes. Code domain multiple axes.
Okay, so what happens if two transmitters transmit a one in the same time? Which code will it be?
Both of them. The base station is capable of decoding up to approximately, and a lot of this has to do with power division and on the downlink and a bunch of other stuff on the base station side, but you ought to be able to wrangle 30 simultaneous occupiers of the exact same spectrum with no issue at all.
So 30 guys are transmitting simultaneously. Each one has its own CDMA code, and the receiver keeps them all separate and gets those 30 channels of information I think that's what you just told us, Bill. Is that true, Bill?
That's correct. And the limit is actually how many people you can, how much power you can devote to all of these codes on the downlink before the cell starts to shrink. Or in other words, you know, its range decreases because of the density of users. It's, but yeah, that's exactly it.
So you have enough.
Hey, Dave.
You have enough orthogonality.
Resolve collision SEC cannot correct more than 4 bits at once, and having so many transmissions at the same time, there is bound to have more errors than 4 bits.
Hold on now. I think he's saying that he has orthogonality 30 deep. He's got 30 gold codes, to put it in simplistic language. Is that what you're saying, Bill? Go ahead, Bill.
Well, yeah, there's 128 codes in a channel, and some of those are designated to things like pilot and paging and sync, but yeah, easily you should be able to wrangle 30 calls in a cell on a single channel, a single 1.25 meg channel simultaneously.
And to repeat what Erickson's saying, because it is so spread spectrum, the fact that a couple of bits get garbled by inter-symbol distortion doesn't matter. In other words, each individual bit of information represents a whole lot of chips of RF transmission of a particular code. So until a whole lot of those chips get inter-symbol distorted, doesn't matter. They can be climbing on top of each other, and the individual CDMA code post-detection integration pulls that information out. Am I even close here, Bill? Over to you, Bill.
Let me read you something, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
All right, this is from the actual group that created CDMA. This paragraph is called The Magic of CDMA. CDMA offers the answer to the capacity problem. The key to its high capacity is the use of noise-like carrier waves, as was first suggested decades ago by Claude Shannon, instead of partitioning either spectrum or time into disjointed slots. Each user is assigned a different instance of the noise carrier. While those waveforms are not rigorously orthogonal, they are nearly so. Practical application of this principle has always used digitally generated pseudo-noise rather than true thermal noise. We do this in digital television, too. The basic benefits are preserved. The transmitters and receivers are simplified because large portions can be implemented using high-density digital devices. I'm going to drop. The major benefit of noise-like carriers is that the system sensitivity to interference is fundamentally altered. Traditional time or frequency slotted spectrum systems must be designed with a reuse ratio that satisfies the worst-case interference scenario. But only a small fraction of the users actually experience that worst case. Use of noise-like carriers, with all users occupying the same spectrum, makes the effective noise the sum of all other user signals. The receiver correlates this input with the desired noise carrier, enhancing the signal-noise ratio at the detector. The enhancement overcomes the sum noise enough to provide an adequate SNR at the detector. Because the interference is summed, the system no longer is sensitive to worst-case interference, but rather to average interference. Let me drop one more time. Frequency use is universal. That is, multiple users utilize each CDMA carrier frequency. Okay, and then they give you a diagram of what the reuse pattern looks like. They line up, it appears as rainbow cells. The rainbow cells indicate that 1.25 megahertz passband is used by each user, and that same passband is reused in each cell. And then they give you the formula of how you get the SNR of the individual users, how you can get the maximum energy, the signal to power ratio, etc., so on and so forth. But I think that gives you a fairly clear idea of what's going on here.
I'm seeing a strong correlation here between what you just described, Eric, and the way a global positioning satellite receiver system works. The GPS system is transmitting 1,024-bit long code. Every one of those GPS satellites is on the exact same frequency, and even if all the birds clump together and you're hearing them all at once, you have no, your receiver has no problem differentiating satellite number 7 versus satellite number 24. It can listen to that one with, I think it's a 35 dB signal-to-noise ratio difference, because it's looking for a particular code and correlating that code 1,024 bits long. And so I don't know how many bits of correlation you've got here, but I think that's where the orthogonality is coming from. Am I off base on this one? Anyone answer who wants to?
Yeah, Dick. My dear.
Okay, yeah. In fact, poor Ed has been standing by, and I forgot to go back to him. As you can tell, these guys are going hot and hairy here, Ed. You've designed some pretty fancy circuits, Mr. Gallander. How would you solve this problem? WB2EAV, K2RIW in the net.
I don't have to solve it. It's solved. It's sitting here. But the point is, when you go to spread spectrum, it is another way of putting multiple signals in the same band. The old way is you give each guy a frequency. A newer way is you give each guy a time slot and everybody transmits bursts. The spread spectrum way is you give everyone a spreading code and the receiver can sort them out, and it's the same thing as sorting them out in different frequencies. You're just spreading them out into unique channels by the pseudo noise code. Now, the reason I called in about half an hour ago is you asked about how often cell phones check in with a cell tower when they're not being used, and I have some easy to replicate experimental evidence for you. WB2EAV.
Sounds beautiful. Go right ahead, Ed. Tell us your experimental evidence as to how fast, how often the thing says, checks into the cell site, your individual cell phone, and says, I'm here, I'm alive and well, and I haven't moved. How often does it do that, Ed?
The test equipment you use is a cell phone, obviously, and a cheap AM radio. Now, you may have to experiment to find the proper cheap AM radio. I have one right here. I'll be more than glad to lend it out for anybody who wants to run this experiment if you can't duplicate it. However, there's a fellow at work who I talk to all the time on the telephone, and his landline phone seems to exhibit the same problem. But when your cell phone is turned on but not in use, I'd say about every 2 to 3 minutes, you get this annoying noise that kind of goes like bip, bip, brap, 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 bip, bip, bip. And when you turn off the cell phone, that never happens. And my experience, admittedly not a statistical survey sample of thousands, but in my home with my cheap AM radio, if I'm listening to the news when I have my cell phone on, or I'm talking to this guy at work, it seems to happen about every 2 to 3 minutes. Dick?
KC2QIQ.
Okay, Glenn, and I bet your Bill's going to have a comment on this. So at least once every 2 minutes, you think it does some kind of an ID. I know Alex is going to want something a little bit more often than that because he's trying to detect somebody that just walked through the door. Glenn, you got it.
I think Ed's right on the money with that one, because I've been watching this. I'm sitting here on my desk during this, and it's happening, and it's intermittent. It's not exactly 2 minutes, but I've seen it happen quickly, like once in about a minute, and then about 2 minutes, but certainly never longer than five. It's definitely less than that. And the other experiment I did while I was sitting here, too, is I took a piece of aluminum foil, wrapped it around the phone so it would disconnect, and pulled the aluminum foil off around the phone again, and sure enough, it came right back on ID pretty loud. Over to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Oh-ho. So in other words, you can put a Faraday cage around the phone, it goes dead, it recognizes somehow the fact that, by the way, what do you believe is the minimum time you put the foil over the phone in which either the phone recognizes it's been disconnected from the universe, or the cell site represents the fact that it's lost that particular client. I wonder how long the foil has got to be over the phone for you to make a difference. What do you think, Glenn?
I'm trying to quantify that. I might give you an answer a little bit later on during the net, because what's happening is when I put the foil on certain areas of the phone, I can make it happen, and then other times I have to wrap the phone all the way around the whole thing. So it's hard to tell when I'm not sure when I'm making the disconnect, if you follow what I'm saying. It putting a time to the shield and when it's actually disconnecting. So let me play with it a little bit longer, see if I can find that out for you, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
Use your microwave, over.
I can see what Alex is going to do next. He's going to create this little bit of an anechoic shielded box with a door on the front. He's going to put his cell phone inside. He's going to periodically open the door. Boy, these guys in Yonkers, I don't know. They've got such interesting problems. And to NNU, KQLIW.
I was suggesting to use the microwave oven. Well, as a Faraday shield. Well, guys, thank you for all the help. You know, I didn't mean to monopolize the whole conversation here. But I guess it's an interesting thought about it. I guess tomorrow is everything closed, but the day after, I'm going to call up some OEM manufacturers of those CDMA modules and whatnot and ask them if they can put it in promiscuous mode and see if they can be used as a detector just for now. However, the detector has to work over a small little battery, a coin battery, and last six months. So there is no easy solution to that one, but I didn't even try to address this one. Back to you, Dick.
I just realized you said a mouthful when you said microwave oven. That microwave oven, the one that I just bought, transmits 1,200 watts out of that magnetron into that little cavity in order to cook my hamburger, so to speak, or cook my cup of coffee real fast, or heat up my glass of water real fast. And the seal on that door is a choke seal that has to have at least 60 decibels of shielding isolation. When I close the door on that microwave oven, 2450 megacycles has been closed off to the universe by 60 decibels or more. Maybe it's even 75 or 80. Now, the cell phone works on a different frequency. The door is not tuned. The choking mechanism of the door is not tuned to that frequency. But still, that's an extremely good Faraday shield, as they say. That's the quickest way. You've got a cubic foot of shielding capability. Every one of us owns a microwave oven. If you want to isolate some RF device, put it in the microwave oven. Don't turn on the microwave oven. Put it in the microwave oven and close the door, and it is now isolated in the universe by some large number of decibels. Hey, that's a handy thing to know about. Anybody got any comments on all of the above? Wow, what crazy things we get into. K2LIW, give me a call, let us a name.
KC2QIQ.
K2QIQ. Glenn and Eric in that order. Anyone else? I think it was a triple there. I got Glenn and Eric. Was there a third person? I heard nothing but a dead carrier. Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn. How well shielded do you think your microwave oven is? And your tinfoil is a poor man's equivalent of a microwave oven. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, well, I'm here. I found actually something a little bit better. What I found was a tin cookie can. And I put the phone inside of that. I just put the cover over it and opened it up. And it takes almost 5 full seconds before something will actually detect again. And then I tried covering it on the other side. And it seems to be about a 5-second delay, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Oh, boy. You're bringing back to my memory an experiment I did roughly 2 years ago where I almost gave a man a heart attack. I'm working with guys who really understand RFID tags. And an RFID tag, it's got to see a roughly minus 13 dBm signal in order for the tag to wake up, to rectify the RF, to power the chip so that it talks back to you. So you have a certain amount of range capability, maybe up to 20 feet you can talk to a tag with a handheld device, a handheld RFID reader, if the tag is in a favorable environment. Put the tag against a bottle of water, and water is very absorptive at 915 megacycles. The range goes down from 20 feet, it goes down to 6 inches real fast. Okay, so I take this device that I call it an RFID tag. I put it inside of a completely shielded cookie can, and I put on the cover. Then I accept that particular RFID tag from 20 feet away. And the engineer who had been working with this stuff for 5 years, he had just lost the faith in Santa Claus, if you know what I mean. He said, how the hell did you do that? Well, it turns out the particular RFID tag happened to be ultrasonic.
the ultrasonic signal had no trouble getting through the tin can and talking to the tag inside, and it started beeping to us. It was a so-called key ringer thing. And so until he found out it was not ultrasonic, and he thought it was RF, he just saw something that was absolutely impossible. Eric, you had a comment? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to point out, if there's a huge interest in the subject, as I'm finding, the protocols and the way the systems work are public. And I just learned just right now, excuse me, that there's something called CDMA-1 and CDMA-2000, and there's a lot of differences between them. But there's all these different white papers that explain the process and how it all happens, and it's all for your viewing on the World Wide Web.
Okay, anybody with any further questions? We've been keeping Andy waiting for an awful long time here, but this is a fascinating problem. These Yonkers guys, I don't know. Look out when they sign in. Anyone have any further comments on this one for tonight, or we can come back in an hour or so if you want to, after we handle Andy's question. Anyone any further comments on the cell phone RFID problem? Give me a call that is right now.
Huge.
Bill, recognize? Anyone else? You're number one on the runway, Bill. Go right ahead.
Hey, there you go. The only thing I can think with regard to phones, where, you know, Glenn's is, seems to be talking more frequently, I can certainly tell you on the IDA network, if you don't necessarily have a distinct server at your location, meaning on your desk, like for example, in my house, I have 5 servers in IDEN. None of them are particularly overpowering. So my device will sit here and talk every 2 or 3 minutes, exactly like those guys are saying. Yet if I'm clearly under the spell of one particular site, and that is my clear and distinct server, it talks much less often. And I'm going to say that that is also more than likely the case with a CDMA device. So that may be why, in certain instances, you're seeing the phone speak more or transmit more frequently than the absolute minimum if you were under the control of one particular clear server and that was it. And that's it. WE2QGZ.
Beautiful. Let me send everyone a caveat. If you put any kind of electronics into a microwave oven and turn on that microwave oven, with rare exception, your chunk of electronics is gone. It's dead. The field strength in volts per meter, or thousands of volts per meter, that microwave oven is capable of creating will destroy any chunk of electronics you got. Not only will the integrated circuit go west and all the transistors are dead, but the board itself will be arcing, sparking, and catch on fire. Terrible things will happen. Make sure if any chunk of electronics is in your microwave oven, there's no way in hell that damn thing can turn on. It's a killer. And that urban edge legend we've heard about some foolish person putting their poodle in the microwave oven in order to dry the dog off after a bath, I sure hope that never took place. Wow. That would kill any animal you put in that microwave oven, even if you just turn it on for 2 seconds. It would do some terrible damage. So the field strength inside of a microwave oven is just out of sight. I mean, I've worked with some extremely high-power jamming transmitters, and you worry about the field strength nearby when personnel are working on the flight line, and can they be exposed to this? That microwave oven can be 10 dB above anything you can normally create, so be careful with that one. Okay, Andy, if you're still there, KB2AZG, I think it was. You're right ahead, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I've been listening. I'm waiting. It's okay. A couple of things before I ask the question. Number one, I'm in the security field, and we utilize part of the cellular band, which is the same thing that updates your clock for a lot of our wireless transmitters, which constantly use the data back and forth. We could track our transmitters, so on and so forth. And we do track a lot of things with a lot of small pieces of RFID equipment, you know, access control, so on and so forth, anything from a half an inch to a half a mile. So just for information, that's number one. Number two, Basically, the part about decoding the phone is done readily now, but the, for, on all phones, the hen is 40,000 and the piece of equipment is about 90,000. And you can track phones anywhere and so on and so forth and reroute them and reroute the signals and so on and so forth. The company, I think it's PRD, that does that. And then I'll ask my question, okay?
Fascinating information. Do you believe that some of the more sophisticated law enforcement agencies have that capability? Andy, go ahead.
I wanted to build it for $10.
Those guys in Yonkers, boy, do they accept the challenge. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, well, yeah, the answer is yes. The answer is 100% yes. I know. I've seen it. I touched it, felt it, and so on and so forth. That's why I was, you know, you were saying decoding, and the simpler way is going to come when you go on the internet, just like years ago when they were cloning phones, and they're going to come up with some little brainiac someplace who's going to just take the phone, plug it into his laptop with a little piece of software and decode it in a couple of minutes. But that's you know, with an Apple or something like that, or your little iPod. The answer is yes to that, yes to all the above. We use that company called Uplink, by the way, is the one that uses all that equipment on the same band you use to the time, and it goes back and forth, and it checks in, checks signal strength, checks location, and we use it for a lot of things. Tracking goes by the way of rail cars, and they just have various points where they track them all over the nation. I was going to use it for a boat race to track late laps. So I do a lot of that work. But on the next note, it's a simpler question, and hopefully it is. I have a black box, so to speak, three big resistors and a dummy load that I bought, and I'm trying to determine how much power this can handle. I have a small dummy load rated at 1500 watts for a couple of seconds, but then I bought this looks like an army surplus deal with these big three gigantic resistors in it. I'm just trying to find out how much this particular unit can handle.
And one of the most interesting black box problems I've ever seen is a circuit. You got two black boxes side by side, and this is not exactly your answer, but it's going to give you some clues. One contains nothing but a 50 ohm resistor. The other circuit contains a sophisticated all-pass network. It's got an inductor, a capacitor, and it's got a bank of resistors. And if you set up the inductor, the capacitor, and the bank of resistors just right, at every possible frequency, it exactly gives you 50 ohms. However, at low frequencies, you're going into resistor number one. At high frequencies, you're going into resistor number two. And so by... there's a technique by which you can transmit a low or a high frequency or a DC signal into one and the other, and because the resistor gets hot, even if it only gets 10 degrees hotter than the environment, if you've got a good enough receiver, you hear the noise of the hot resistor versus the noise of a room temperature resistor. You look at the noise power, a noise figure meter will do this for you. Therefore, you can differentiate one box versus the other. One of them has got noise that's got a frequency slant to it, and the other one's got noise that's completely broadband. So by putting a small amount of power into your unknown dummy load and detecting how much heat comes out, because a noise figure meter will tell you that, hey, that resistor is now not at 290 Kelvin room temperature, it's at 300 degree Kelvin. You've heated it up by 10 degrees. The rate at which it heats as you put a known amount of power will give you a pretty strong clue as to how much power you can put in there before you burn it up. You only have to open up the box, say, for instance, a sealed unit. So you know darn well that the resistor can probably take 100 degrees C, but beyond that, you may be going to do damage. So by looking at the rate of heating, by looking at the noise power the resistor makes when you put a known amount of just DC current through it, and watch the sensitive receiver noise power go up, you'll get a clue real fast. I didn't say it's an easy solution. It's at least solution number one. I wonder if you see what I'm saying there, Andy. KB2AZG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2EAV.
Ed recognized, but Andy first. It's his question. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, I can see the rate of which arrives with a specific known voltage and current, that, and there's a formula that does that, which I'm not familiar with, and maybe I can get an email to KB2AZ@AOOL.net. But yeah, that makes sense. And I do know that there's I've got these resistors, and the fact that it says 140R on it, and it's 8 inches long and 1 inch thick. I was wondering. I thought it was hoping it's just a resistor load. If I put an inductive a unit that an inductance meter fitted out in. There you go. I should be able to tell, make sure it's not a wire wound one, because this was supposedly used as a resistive dummy load.
Yeah, again, sweeping in frequency. A network analyzer, which sweeps in frequency and looks at the reactants and versus resistance, plots it on the Smith chart. Right away, by the characteristic curve you get on the Smith chart display of a network analyzer, you'll tell the difference right away between a wire wound resistor, a foil wound resistor that's been laser trimmed, an Allen Bradley carbon composition resistor. They've all got a very characteristic curve. And you could even tell the difference in the characteristic curve if I've got two Allen Bradley resistors in two separate black boxes. One of them has long leads and one of them has short leads. The extra inductance of the leads on the 50 ohm Allen Bradley resistor, I can tell the difference of that on the signature I'll get on the Smith chart display of a network analyzer. That network analyzer, you use it correctly, boy, it's giving you a mountain of information. It's giving you so damn many answers, and you're not quite sure what the question is. I bet you Ed's done some of this work. WB2EAV, K2LIW.
Oh, I've dabbled in it. Couple of thoughts. Item number one. Verify it really is 50 ohms resistive at the frequency you want to use it. There are various ways to do that. The ultimate is with a network analyzer. I believe MFJ and temp analyzers, which you probably could borrow from a friend, would do. An SWR bridge that you have faith in would do. Second, dummy loads, commercial dummy loads, are built to radiate heat to the air. And I assume any sane commercial designer would have the exterior thermal radiating surface at RF ground. So it's a very, very precise scientific experiment. Assuming the outside case is at RF ground, put your hand on it while you're transmitting into it. And when you hear your voice saying, wow, this sucker's getting hot, you've exceeded the maximum power rating. Back to Dick.
Sounds like the maximum ouch test. Boy, these guys got interesting problems. Andy, you got it.
KC2QIQ.
Andy first. Glenn recognized. Andy, go ahead.
Okay, well, I do have an antenna analyzer, and it should tell me at a certain, I guess, with frequency, and that it's going to give me a specific load. It's going to tell me that, the resistance. And I'm not trying to start a campfire with it there at Osceola, so go ahead, pick it up.
Yeah, if you measure the standing wave ratio at your favorite frequency and use the lowest power that your standing wave ratio meter will work, that's going to give you a lot of information. It'll tell you how resistor versus reactive, or whether or not there's an error in the resistance. But believe it or not, if I look at a 50 ohm resistor that's perfect, and I measure either the standing wave ratio or the network analyzer response, which is called S11 scattering parameter, in either case, it's VSWR. I could see on a really good resistor minus 40 dB reflection coefficient. If now I add 5 ohms of resistance, so it's a 55 ohm resistor instead of a 50, I'm not sure of the exact number, you go down to a minus 20 dB reflection. And whether I add 5 ohms of reactance in series with a 50 ohm resistor, or 5 ohms of resistance in series with a 50 ohm resistor, in either case, the standing wave ratio goes up by the same amount. So you can rather rapidly figure out the error in 50 ohmsness, and then by sweeping it in frequency, do the measurement at 30 megs and 144 megs and 432 megs, you'll know right away the rate of change, whether or not the error is inductive or resistive. In one case, it'll if it's an inductive error, the VSWR goes up real fast versus frequency. So from the outside of a black box, if you're smart enough, you'd be amazed how much information you get out of that. Glenn, KCQ, QIQ, you got it.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. One of the things I do here whenever I test demi loads, just to see, because a lot of times you see the ratings on the outside, and they're, even with the ratings that the manufacturers give you sometimes, are a little scary. So one of the things I normally do here is I'll usually, to check the frequency span, I use my little MFJ-269 antenna analyzer and just kind of sweep it and see, you know, the bands that I would normally be testing equipment on to see if it's a good match in those areas. And as far as the power rating, what I do here is I've got a nice hefty DC power supply. It's capable of about 80 volts and puts out about 30 amps or so. And what I do is I put a little a thermocouple on one of the resistors, and what I do is I start increasing the DC voltage on the load just to see when it gets to about the 200 degree Celsius area. When it starts hitting about that, it's pretty close to runaway, and that's where, you know, you look at the amount of power it's taking and how long it took to rise to that temperature, and that's really the kind of power that it's rated for. And sometimes I find too, if you add a little fan to the outside, that tends to also increase the amount of power that you can dissipate and the amount of time you put it into the dummy load. KC2QIQ.
Now let me tell you guys about the poor man's dummy load. If, for instance, I've got a dummy load that's only good for 10 watts, but I've got a 100-watt transmitter and I want to run it key down for 10 minutes, no way in hell can you do that. However, if I take the right length of RG8 cable followed by a length of RG58 cable, and the cable, I'm using 100 feet of cable in each case, so I know its insertion loss. And then at the tail end of that cable, I put my 10-ohm dummy load, 10-watt dummy load. I'm now distributing that power into a beautiful 50-ohm system. Those cables got a nice length. They can dissipate the power very nicely. I can now put lots of kilowatts into that poor man's dummy load by using cable. The only slight disadvantage of that technique is that if at the far end I've got my bird watt meter, and I'm looking at the power coming out of the bird watt meter as a way of detecting whether or not my 100-watt transmitter fades when I run a key down for 10 minutes, then I've got a little bit of a problem, because the coax cable, as it heats up, its insertion loss increases. The bird watt meter at the far end is going to slowly decrease, and I could have a false alarm thinking that my transmitter is fading. In reality, my dummy load is increasing in its insertion loss, the cable portion of it. So be a little bit careful on that one. But a beautiful high-power poor man's dummy load is a length of cable. We've all got lengths of cable around, particularly the length of cable that's been sitting on the basement floor for a long period of time, and it's absorbed a little bit of water, and boy, does it have loss. And in this case, it's going to work like a charm. So what's the nature of the dummy load you're testing here, Andy? KB2AZG, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, minor correction before we go to that.
Go ahead, Ed.
You didn't mention frequency. At VHF and UHF, yeah, 100 feet of cheap coax will do that perfectly. At 80 meters, it won't do squat.
If I choose some really yucky, slightly waterlogged RG58, I got a 100-foot length of it. At 80 meters, I'm going to get a fair amount of loss. After it, I can follow it with some super miniature diameter flexible coax cable. There's ways I can get a lot of loss out of coax cable, even at 80 meters. Making lousy transmission lines is almost easy, Ed, if you're smart enough. But you're absolutely right. At low frequencies, it becomes a lot more difficult, but I think it's still doable. Andy, what kind of a dummy load are you testing there, Andy? AZG, RIW?
What do you mean, what kind? I wanted it for my HF, so three big resistors in a box. It says 50-ohm resistive load on it with a little sticker on it. I don't know what exactly question you're trying to ask.
Hey, Dick, I got a question for you.
Yeah, hold on there, Ed. If you can open up the box and physically see the resistors, I mean, I know you can recognize the difference between a 100-watt dummy load resistor versus a half-watt carbon composition. Looking at the physical size of the resistor is going to give you a strong clue as to how many watts it can take without overheating. So I thought your black box is sealed. If you can actually open it up and look at the resistors, you're halfway home. Back to you, Andy.
Okay, well, yes, I did open it up. Yeah, it's right in front of me. It's, why is it black box? It's because I didn't know what's on it. All I know is there's three resistors in parallel that that make up the 48 ohms that I measure with my ohmmeter. And the resistors are approximately, I think they're about 9 inches long, and they're about one and a quarter inches thick.
Dick, there should be a marking on the end of those K2JJ.
Okay, is this a Heathkit antenna or something like that you're talking about, Andy?
I don't know if it's Heathkit. It was just, you know, I picked it up at a ham fest. It's in a it's a square box with an end connector on it, and it's green. And it says on the end of the resistor, the only thing I see is 140R.
That's a 140-watt resistor at the K2JJ.
140 ohms.
Well, we'll soon find out. Ed, I know you wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, Ed.
Well, first of all, 140R would be 140 ohms because R is often used to mark a decimal point on power resistors. A dummy load has to conduct the heat from the resistors to the outer surface of the box. Usually it uses some kind of distributed resistance along the surface of it. The Heathkit antenna, which Dick is referring to, which may be relevant to this discussion, was a gallon paint can with resistors in it on the cover, and you filled the whole thing up with transformer oil, which conducted the heat from the resistors to the case. So the question is it possible this box is waterproof, actually oil-proof, and meant to be filled with oil to conduct the heat away? Because if you have a sealed box, sooner or later those resistors are going to burn up, because their power rating is predicated on free air flow for a power resistor. And what I wanted to say before, Dick, was, well, I agree with you totally that a waterlogged 100 feet of coax makes one heck of a good dummy load. It would be a lot cheaper to buy yourself a proper dummy load than to get that lawyer, that letter from your wife's attorney. Dick?
Okay. Interesting way of looking at it. If I put three resistors in parallel, and each of those resistors was 150 ohms each, I end up with, I think, a 50-ohm resistor. If the three resistors are 140 ohms, but they're made to be 140 ohms at DC, and at RF frequencies, they got a little bit of extra reactance, a little bit of extra resistance, and they come closer to 150, that's a way of making a dummy load. So those numbers that he sees on the resistors probably are ohms, not watts. But Ed's got a very good point there. A 100-watt resistor in free air is not a 100-watt resistor when it's in a sealed container. Unless there's an oil bath around it and it spins on the outside of the container, then your 100-watt resistor might be a 300-watt resistor, because the oil is doing such a good job of cooling the resistor, and the fins on the outside of the can are doing a good job of cooling the oil. So there's multiple steps to how, as to how the joules of energy you're putting into your resistor, how does that energy finally dissipate itself out into the universe? There's individual steps. The way they make a schematic diagram of that is the schematic diagram has got a bunch of thermal resistors, and you add up the thermal resistance of each one of those junctions. Like, if I've got a TO3 transistor, and from the junction of the real active silicon device inside to that case, I've got a certain number of ohms per watt. Degrees centigrade per watt. Degrees per watt, I think, is the thermal resistance. And then whether or not I put silicon grease on that, between that and the heatsink, I got another number of degrees per watt. And then the heatsink itself, depending on how big it is, it has some number of degrees per watt to the universe. So you add up those resistors, you figure out how many watts you're putting in, you'll eventually calculate how many degrees of rise in temperature your junction of your silicon transistor inside of the package is going to get. And your dummy load is really a situation somewhat like that. I think you see the picture, Andy. KB2, AZG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Special oil, transformer oil, actually.
Understand. Glenn and Alex recognized, but Andy first, go ahead, Andy.
Okay, well, first of all, it's not in a can. It's not sealed. It's It's a rectangular box with many holes in it, and it's air. It's sitting in on, and each end of the resistor I got two has a ceramic little round device or piece with a nut on it, and it goes to a quarter inch plate steel mounted in this little box. And so it is air, and it is not, and wasn't made for oil, and it's probably not heat kit.